The Gates of Horn and Ivory, by Francis Rosenfeld. Chapter 3. Summer Festival. Welcome back, daughter, her mother greeted her, all smiles, at the mouth of the cave. Persephone felt a little stiff from sleeping on the ground and still a little turned around after traveling back and forth twice between worlds within the boundaries of one night. I take it you had a pleasant journey home, Demeter continued, way too cheerful so early in the morning. How is your husband?
He's well, thank you, Persephone mumbled, squinting from the crude light.
I take it your followers are still looking for you, her mother pointed to the group, which meandered through the forest and valleys carrying torches in the middle of the day. I wouldn't deprive them of the excitement of finding me, eventually.
Let's give them a few hours.
I have a few things to tend to in the meantime.
Your husband gave you homework, dear?
No. It's a favor I promised a friend. In fact, I was wondering if you'd be able to help.
It's a plant.
For Proteus. When you spend so much time switching between realities, whether it's from death to life or from sleep to consciousness, you are bound to cross paths with the shape-shifting god of the unconscious, whose gift of prophecy and ability to alter the properties of matter were unmatched, even among the gods. Most often than not, one didn't even know when one ran into Proteus, since the latter amused himself by showing up as a seal, a river, or a tree. His body was prima materia, which could transform itself at will and transmute into anything. For help with matters that would remain unmentioned, Persephone had promised the whimsical deity a surprise, and was trying to come up with something unusual enough not to disappoint.
What on earth is this, daughter? Her mother laughed out loud when she saw the production.
Atop a glut of glossy oblong leaves, reminiscent of Daphne or Magnolia, sat a bright pink artichoke, which looked almost too large and too heavy for its sturdy stem. As the sun's rays reached it, the artichoke unfurled its fleshy petals to reveal the giant eye in the middle, surrounded by a profusion of tiny tentacles, which reached out to sense their surroundings as if guided by an inner force. The flower, now poised to reach the size of a dinner plate, wobbled tentatively on top of its stem for a moment, and then burst open its second layer of petals, the ones that were tightly packed to form the eye at the center, expanding them into a colorful pincushion, whose sappy spikes moved with the slightest breeze. The whole assembly glowed in fiery shades of red, yellow, and fuchsia, and its appearance felt ancient, like some of the plant species Persephone remembered from a very long time ago, long before humans were born to this earth. Why, it's a protea, of course, she burst out laughing, while the large group, carrying torches, saw her from afar and started running in her direction.
Oops.
They found me, she sketched an impish smile and then returned to the seriousness her role demanded. The group approached Demeter to give her the good news of having found her daughter unharmed, and the former, with great dedication to the thespian craft, welcomed her child effusively, as if she'd seen her after a long and perilous absence. The things we do for mortals, she whispered in her daughter's ear before she released her from the embrace and moved her to her side to receive the ritual offerings of flowers and grain.
Who do they think we are? Persephone asked.
The temple priestesses, I think. Things get very confusing during ritual. Gods wear disguises in order to pass for humans, while humans invoke the divine in order to pass for gods. In the end, you never know who you were looking at, or whether they were mortal or divine. The Platonic ideals like to play with the human mind for a while, giving it the illusion of power and control, only to pull the rug from under it at the most inopportune moment, just to amuse themselves. That's all the gods were, after all, ideals, personifications of nature, powerful archetypes. The human imagination had given them substance, but they were so much more powerful than the minds that created them, taking over entire generations and shaping their progress, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, completely indifferent to right and wrong, slaves only to their own survival and whims. The goddesses were embodied by priestesses pretending to be goddesses, whom the faithful used to worship the latter by proxy, while in fact speaking directly to them. One had to take a break from this kind of thinking before one's mind spun out of control.
We praise you, Goddess Ops, patron and protector of the crop. The group chanted.
That's you, Persephone looked at her mother.
No, I believe that's you, dear, her mother laughed. People often confused them for each other and misinterpreted their family connection, so they often worshipped the two goddesses interchangeably. After all, it was the result that counted, not its facilitator. The tall priestess with the tri-faced mask and the torch took Demeter's hand to guide her to a small pool in a clearing, which bubbled from an unseen source below it, and whose waters were still, dark, and frigid, as one would expect from an essence hailing from the underworld. Those waters of Hades surfaced sometimes in little rocky wells, only to disappear again, sucked into the depths of the earth, and re-emerge miles away, as if from nowhere, their underground path a perpetual mystery. Their otherworldly essence was always instantly recognizable to people, who never mistook their dark and still waters for normal brooks and streams, just as they didn't mistake the ghostly breath of the Cave of Tenerus for regular mist. Where knowledge fails, instinct comes to substitute, that inner feeling that raises the hairs on your back in the presence of the ineffable. The dark waters of the underworld were gateways to its realm. Everybody knew, feared, and respected that. Demeter bent over to see her reflection in the pool, and the face of her daughter looked back at her from its surface. She reached into the water and pulled Persephone out, and everybody witnessed the latter emerge, completely dry, from the waters of Hades, crowned with narcissi and holding a sheaf of grains. As the worshippers gathered around them again, to throw flowers at their feet, Demeter couldn't help her curiosity. "You know, daughter, you never told me how this works. You emerging from reflection into reality. I can't tell you. It's an underworld secret," the latter responded, cryptic, to her mother's annoyance. The ceremonies of descent, search, and ascent had ended, things have been done, said, and shown, and the supplicants' rituals were now coming to an end. They bowed respectfully to the goddesses and started on their way home. Many had traveled a long way to be here for the mysteries, and having partaken in their physically demanding challenges, were looking forward to a warm bed and a hearty meal. "Did you appear to all of them?"
"Of course.
I'm not sure how many will remember it, though.
And if they do, at what level of detail?"
Frequently, the seekers of the mysteries couldn't remember having met Persephone in their dreams at all, and were disappointed, thinking their trip had been in vain. But in the deeper waters of their mind, where thought doesn't dare enter and feelings reign supreme, their impressions of her were clear and unshakable, and made themselves manifest in ways that boggled the mind, in strange emotions they didn't understand, in omens and premonitions, in instant knowledge that didn't seem to have an explanation, in art and discovery. Many wonderful plays, poems, and musical masterpieces had been born of these seeds of inspiration she planted deep into the artists' minds. The muses were her friends, and the goddess of memory, Memosyne, was often by her side, to bring up from the depths of their mind things they thought long forgotten, at the drop of a pin, the sound of a voice, the scent of a flower. No trip to experience the mysteries was ever wasted, Persephone made sure of that. Hades was sometimes amused by the dedication she put into inspiring the minds of her followers, but helped her in any way he could, just to see his beautiful bride happy. Her smile was the entire world to him, and it shone brighter than all the fires of Tartarus, a mixed metaphor Persephone had learned to love and appreciate in the spirit in which it was offered. "Who compares a wife to the fires of Tartarus?" she'd asked him, outraged. "The same person who made her its queen, my love," he had replied. In the end, paradise is where the love is, and Persephone loved the Elysium fields and the Tartarus equally, because they both belong to her home, to her kingdom of emotions so warm and comforting compared to the bone-chilling brightness of Olympus. Nobody sent the blessed to their great rewards there. "Rest up, dear," her mother told Persephone as she opened the door to her chambers to retire for the night. "You have a full schedule tomorrow. You'll be meeting the midwives to bless their hands." Persephone remembered the 2,000 souls waiting for their time to be born, perched on rooftops, sea walls, and stone plazas, and was actually eager to make sure their arrival into this world was assisted by skilled hands. She made a mental list of topics, from good standard practices to medicinal plants to aid in maternal health, and from hygiene to feeding, until she was too tired, left the rest for the following day, and slipped into a sleep without dreams.